from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's American tax law beloved by some of the richest Americans that Donald Trump calls ridiculous. Getting away with murder is the carried interest provision. It goes back to Venetian sea captains who got a big bonus for risky cargoes. These days, it's feeding private equity and hedge fund managers a huge tax break on huge profits. Defenders say it's the secret sauce. Trump says kill it. So does President Obama. Now, Jeb Bush wants to take a whack at it. This hour On Point, carried interest, the rich, the middle class, and tax plans on the GOP campaign trail. And later this hour, we will look at how automaker Volkswagen allegedly programmed a massive evasion of emission controls into its cars. But first, taxes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Should the finance guys pay at a different rate than the rest? Is Trump right? Are they getting away with murder? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Who would have thought it? The hedge fund guy, the Republican candidate at the head of the pack, Donald Trump, the billionaire, coming out to say this is not the way to go. Carried interest he's talking about here. Special treatment for these earnings. And he's talking here with CBS, Face the Nation, in August, saying these hedge fund guys are making huge amounts of money just pushing paper. Pay no tax. It's ridiculous.
The hedge funds guys didn't build this country. These are guys that shift paper around and they get lucky. And by the way, when the market collapses like it is now, the market's going down, they're losing a fortune. Half of them, look, they're energetic, they're very smart, but a lot of them, it's like they're paper pushers. They make a fortune, they pay no tax. It's ridiculous, okay?
It's ridiculous. Okay, amen, says the President of the United States. Here he was last week at the Business Roundtable on Wednesday saying the carried interest provision is not good for the U.S. economy. President Obama.
Two leading candidates on the Republican side who have said that we should eliminate the carried interest loophole. Now, there's disagreement in this room around that. But I will tell you that keeping this tax loophole, which leads to folks who are doing very well paying lower rates than their secretaries is not in any demonstrable way improving our economy.
Two leading GOP candidates, as the president says there. He's there, including Jeb Bush, who's also looking in this direction. Joining me first today from Washington is Fawn Johnson, formerly political correspondent for the National Journal. She is now chief policy editor for Morning Consult, is an online policy news service with a target audience of movers and shakers. Fawn Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. So Donald Trump, billionaire, like Warren Buffett before him, billionaire, is very critical of the carried interest provision that lets private equity guys and gals and others pay a capital gains rate on what some look at and say, hey, that's earnings. Trump says he hasn't unveiled his tax plans yet, but he says he's willing, he's ready, he's going to, get rid of it. Is that what he seems to be promising?
That sounds to me like what he's promising. And it's fascinating to watch this debate escalate in a way that only Donald Trump can escalate such a debate. It used to be that if you wanted to write about carried interest, you would not be putting it in a headline because people would automatically snooze and turn the page. So that's fascinating. And it is also one of the interesting things about Trump that he is bringing this sort of you would not think a Republican, particularly one who is a billionaire like him, to be talking about getting rid of what is essentially a tax break for people who invest in sort of risky markets. That's the whole point of it. Mm-hmm. And there's been a number of calls over the years, 10 years, 15 years back, to get rid of this particular provision in the tax code. And really the only question I think for a lot of people who are involved in this day in and day out is, do you get rid of it on its own, or do you do it as a part of broader tax reform? Because it could be seen as a trade-off for other kinds of business tax breaks that may be considered a little more fair.
Everybody wants to do deals when it comes to anything with taxes. It's
right.
All chits on the table. But Trump just has gone straight at this. Here he was some more on Face the Nation. This was in August again, saying getting away with murder with this.
The hedge fund guys are getting away with murder. They're making a tremendous amount of money. They have to pay tax. I want to lower the rates for the middle class. The middle class is the one. They're getting absolutely destroyed This country doesn't have, won't have a middle class very soon.
And more. Billionaire Trump really harping on this, saying, hey, a lot of candidates, he calls out Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush here, are controlled by the finance guys, not me. Let's go. Here's Trump.
Hillary and Jeb, in particular, are totally controlled by the hedge fund guys and, you know, the Wall Street guys, but hedge funds in particular. So they pay very little tax, and that's going to end when I come out with my plan in about 3 weeks. Could be sooner than that. We have an amazing tax plan. We're going to be reducing taxes for the middle class, but for the hedge fund guys, they're going to be paying up.
We haven't seen Trump's plan yet, Fawn Johnson, but
that's correct.
But Hillary says she would also go after the carried interest provision.
Yep.
And so does Jeb Bush. What would Jeb do? He's got his plan out last week, his tax
Jeb
plan.
Jeb actually has, I mean, he has a pretty robust for the candidates plan that talks about all of this stuff. So he would, in fact, the carried interest provision would be eliminated, but it's in part of a broader context. So one of the things that he would do is he would he would eliminate the estate tax, and then he would also lower the overall tax rate on not just on corporations generally, but also for capital gains. And if so, his overall plan kind of mutes the idea that particular provision for people who are basically making their money off of investments and trades, they would be paying the same amount that, say, somebody would be just from, you know, being, say, the CEO of Starbucks. So in effect, I think under Jeb Bush's plan, what you're looking at is everybody would be paying a little less taxes. The only question for him is how much is that going to cost the country? The difference between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush is that Jeb Bush has a comprehensive plan out there, you know, in the sense that it's bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't gotten into the details, where this is the only detail that Donald Trump has really put out there. And so I think it's important to understand that the carried interest loophole, as some people call it, if you were to get rid of it, it would give about $15 billion to the general treasury over the course of the next 10 years, which is certainly not nothing. But when you put it in context for the entire tax code, you know, Jeb Bush's plan could cost anywhere from $1.5 to $3 trillion, depending on how you judge the growth factors in it. The some of the flat tax proposals that Senator Rand Paul and others have put out would be $3 trillion and counting. So $15 billion is really not that much when you're talking about a much bigger tax plan. But, you know, Donald Trump has found a good enemy to go after. Hedge fund people aren't particularly popular among the populace, and has used that as a way of building up a tax plan that we haven't seen the rest of it. So we don't really know how else it would affect us.
And it is interesting, a moment when you got others piling in here, including the former governor of New York, where this is a very big business. This was last week on CNN. He's nowhere near the front of the pack, almost invisible, but former Governor George Pataki talked with the moderator Hugh Hewitt there, saying that he, too, would get rid of the carried interest break in the tax code. Here's Pataki.
The normal American person is paying higher taxes than they should because of loopholes, and one of them is that carried interest loophole. I would tax that income the same as ordinary income. I'd lower the rate to 24% for all Americans, but I would not give a special break to the Wall Street fat caps.
So you are with Jeb Bush and Donald Trump on
it's
the hedge fund?
It's hard for me to say that I'm with Donald Trump on anything, but on this issue, I agree with him.
It's a live issue right now, though it's been alive before, and no one has ever managed to succeed, really, in whacking this back. Fawn Johnson, stand by with Morning Consult there in Washington. Victor Fleischer joins us right now from San Diego. He's a professor of law, University of San Diego, teaches tax policy there. Big, big expert on this front, author of Legacy, the forthcoming Legacy, Entrepreneurial Success and the New Inequality. Victor Fleischer, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can you explain the carried interest provision, its origins, and how it's working these days?
Sure. So I came to this topic about 10 years ago. I was concerned about the growing trend of inequality, and in particular, that the top 1% and the top 1% of the top 1% are capturing an increasing share of income in the United States. And what's interesting is that a large number of these folks in the top 1% of the 1% earn their money through what's known as carried interest, as we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what carried interest is the share of partnership profits from an investment fund. And it's typically a private equity fund rather than a hedge fund.
Could be venture capital, but private equity above all here, yeah.
Right. Private equity, venture capital, real estate, some hedge funds. And it might be worth taking a moment just to explain what a private equity fund does. A private equity fund takes money from institutional investors. These are mostly pension funds, state pension funds, university endowments, insurance companies, other institutional investors. And the private equity fund managers take that money and they buy a company or a division of a company. And they hold that in a partnership for 5 to 10 years. And they make changes. They put in new management. They fire workers. They try to expand the business.
This was Mitt Romney's business.
That's correct, at Bain Capital. And then they try to sell the company at a profit, either back to the public or to another financial or trade buyer. And in exchange for managing this money and managing these companies, they take what's known as 2 and 20. 2 is a 2% annual management fee, and 20 is the 20% of profits that they will take. So let's say that there's a billion-dollar fund, which is a typical size for a private equity fund. And let's say 10 years later, they turn that into $3 billion. So there's $2 billion in profits. The fund managers get about $20 million a year in fees, management fees, and those are taxed at ordinary income rates. And then there's the 20% of profits. 20% of the $2 billion would be about $400 million in carried interest.
Which some say that's just their pay. They say, no, that's return on investment should be treated like capital gains, carried interest.
That's right. And so they pay a capital gains rate on that, and that's the issue that I've been focused on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the tax reform that President Obama and Donald Trump and now Jeb Bush agree on, ending the carried interest break that has lined the pockets of many, the top 1% of 1% of Americans, my guest Victor Fleischer says today. He's at the University of San Diego. Fawn Johnson is with us from Morning Consult in Washington. This is suddenly a live issue again after billionaire Trump has put it right on the table. Ryan Ellis joins us in a moment. He's very much in favor of keeping it going. Others, not so much. We heard Pataki, Jeb Bush is there, Donald Trump is there now here. This summer in New York, Hillary Clinton talking about her economic policy and specifically talked about this front where carried interest comes into play.
First, hardworking families need and deserve tax relief and simplification. Second, those at the top have to pay their fair share. That's why I support the Buffett rule, which makes sure that millionaires don't pay lower rates than their secretaries. I've also called for closing the carried interest loophole, which lets wealthy financiers pay an artificially low rate.
Hillary Clinton over the summer, she got pushback on that. Of course, she's had lots of contributors, as many politicians have, from hedge fund people and others. Here was an interview also over the summer. Omega Advisors hedge fund manager, billionaire Leon Cooperman, really laid it on Hillary Clinton with her summers in the vineyard in the Hamptons after she called for closure of the carried interest tax break.
I don't need anybody crapping all over what I do for a living, who particularly hangs out with all these people in Martha's Vineyard and in the Hamptons, and then the very first thing she has to say is to criticize hedge funds. Okay, I've lived the American dream. I have nothing to apologize for. I've made a lot of money. I'm giving it all back to society.
Okay, so has, I guess Donald Trump would say he's lived the dream as well. But he says, let's go. Here's one more bite of Trump at the Republican presidential debate at the Reagan Library just last week.
We've had a graduated tax system for many years, so it's not a socialistic thing. What I'd like to do is, and I'll be putting in the plan in about 2 weeks, and I think people are going to like it. It's a major reduction in taxes. It's a major reduction for the middle class. The hedge fund guys won't like me as much as they like me right now. I know them all, but they'll pay more. I know people that are making a tremendous amount of money and paying virtually no tax, and I think it's unfair.
Now, there are plans coming out from Jeb Bush, from Marco Rubio, from Rand Paul. Overall, looking at Associated Press here, the bottom line is that they look like they would do very well by the wealthy in this country, too well, say even some conservatives. National Review writing Republicans should be countering the caricature of themselves as slavishly devoted to the interests of rich people and corporations, not playing into it. But that's where they're headed. Warren Buffett, of course, he's talked about this a lot. You got, on the other hand, tough critics. Ryan Ellis, who joins us in a moment, says that it's just a dumb idea to get rid of carried interest. It makes no sense as a matter of tax policy. Makes no sense if your goal is to soak the rich. He says it's the triumph of feelings over thinking, emotion over reason. Victor Fleischer, is there a thoughtful case for dumping this tax break?
The thoughtful case goes back to the nature of the income that's being earned. Nobody's saying that the investors in these funds, the pension funds, the insurance companies, the banks, their tax rate would not change. The focus is on the fund managers mm-hmm. who provide labor and services to the fund. And compensation for services in our system, labor income, is supposed to be taxed at ordinary rates. And usually the response is, well, this is risky. This is... we need to be compensated for risk. But that's not the way our system works. If you're a real estate agent and you're hoping for a 6% commission, that's risky. If you get your commission, it's still ordinary income. If you're a journalist trying to sell a book and you do, it's ordinary income. If you buy a lottery ticket and you happen to hit, what's riskier than that? That's ordinary income. And so this is really an anomaly in the tax system that the fund managers – many of whom make tens or hundreds of million in carried interest a year, pay tax at a low rate, at a lower rate than school teacher or a firefighter or a cop. That is the heart of the injustice here, and that's the case for changing the tax treatment.
Hedge funds did not have a particularly good year last year, and even so, looking here at a Times report, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned a combined $11.6 billion, average of $467 million each. Recent year, looking at their taxes, they paid the second lowest average federal tax rate since data has been collected, 16.7%. And of course, a whole lot of lower income Americans, pay more than that. Ray's calling
and
from
Tom,
yes, Victor.
Tom, I think you probably saw you quoted the top 25 hedge fund managers. There's also a famous comparison. They earned more than all of the kindergarten teachers in the United States combined last year.
So do with that what you will. Ryan Ellis may say that's emotion over reason. We'll ask him in just a moment. Ray in Milwaukee. Ray, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you for doing this show. Of course, these tax breaks should be given up. These hedge fund managers and private equity, they're like a cancer on our system because they have torn apart the fabric of the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This used to be a factory town. You could leave one job, walk across the street, and find another. But since all this has taken place in the last 25 years, I would say, Milwaukee has just hollowed out as Detroit, as all these other cities, as these hedge fund managers have broken apart these giant, giant companies. And majority of them, if they're not just shredded and thrown in the garbage, they've gone to China. Now, we should change the rules of how they operate. For instance, if they do wind up firing 10,000 people from one factory, they should be responsible for job training and making sure that these workers have work to do. Otherwise, what is the point of capitalism if there is nobody to buy the goods?
Stick with us, Ray. Fawn Johnson, President Obama says, I think he wants to close this loophole and use some of that to help more students go to college, maybe even to look at job training.
Absolutely. And actually, I mean, the caller makes the point that I think Democrats have been making on Capitol Hill. This, you won't hear this as much in the presidential debates, but on Capitol Hill, one of the big games, and it's an important game that members play, is how do you pay for the legislation that you pass? So currently, just looking at how we fund the government for the next several months as we're trying to figure out a broader budget package, it is the central question that lawmakers ask. And there are many Democrats, and actually I would say most at this point, but the tax writers in particular have pointed to carried interest as a really easy way to, if you get rid of that particular tax provision, you would add $15 billion onto the Treasury that you could use to pay for job training programs or for better student loan rates or, you know, expanding the Pell Grants, name it. There's any number of things that people want to use it for. So that's the context. It's interesting because that's how members of Congress have been talking about it, particularly Democrats. And they've been doing it in a pretty coordinated way for about the last month. And I think they've been given a little boost by Donald Trump, which is always interesting to see.
Hey, Ray in Milwaukee, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Listen with us, if you would, Ray. Here's Ben Carson. This was also at the GOP debate last week, saying, no, you know, don't get rid of carried interest, the break. But he wants a flat tax, but he's not about – well, listen, and I want your response, if you would, Ray. Here's Ben Carson.
The people who say the guy who paid $1 billion because he had 10, he's still got $9 billion left. That's not fair. We need to take more of his money. That's called socialism. That doesn't work so well. What made America into a great nation was the fact that we said, that guy just put in $1 billion. Let's create an environment that's even more conducive to his success so that next year he can put in $2 billion.
Ray, in Milwaukee, there's the argument. Guy makes $10 billion. You take a billion. That's not great. $2 billion, that's worse.
All the jobs that hedge fund manager wiped out in this country negates the billion he's put in. It's a joke. I mean, this kind of math doesn't make any sense, especially from this neurosurgeon. I mean, who does he think he's fooling?
Ray, I appreciate your call. Victor Fleischer in San Diego, Fawn Johnson in Washington, please stand by. Ryan Ellis joins us right now. He is tax policy director at Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform. He has been designated by the IRS as an enrolled agent, identifies him as one of the top tax experts practicing today. Very critical of the idea of getting rid of the carried interest provision. Ryan Ellis, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You say it is an idea born of impassioned ignorance combined with a singular stupidity, populism at its worst and ugliest. Donald Trump and others now say enough already. We don't need this. Let's reshuffle the deck. What do you say, Ryan?
Well, what I say is that people that are for this are pretending that a capital gain, and that's what we're talking about here. A partnership has an investment. They use partnership money to buy an asset. That asset grows. They sell the asset. I don't think anybody reasonable would say that the partnership is sitting on anything other than a capital gain at that point. So what we're really talking about is pretending that what that capital gain is for some people is a capital gain, and what that capital gain is for other partners is suddenly not a capital gain.
But aren't you really also pretending that the private equity guys are full partners in this? Because their amount of equity, if there's any of their own money in there, it would be very small, yet they're going to take a 20% slice of that
matter.
Pie.
Well, that doesn't matter.
Isn't that a kind of pretending?
It's not their gain. It's the partnership's gain. The partnership has basis.
But money ends up in their pocket, and 20% of it, let's say $1 billion gain, that's not too shabby.
Look, a partnership, an investment partnership, has money that it raises from limited partners. Mm-hmm. It takes that money and invests the assets, and it looks to have a gain. Now, in the United States of America, we have very flexible partnership rules. The partnership rules are set by a partnership agreement, and the partnership agreement says, we're going to divvy up any profits this partnership makes according to these rules. It's not according to how much money you put in. It's not according to whether we think you're an evil rich person or you're a benighted pension fund. It doesn't matter. The partnership agreement says that we're going to take income from this partnership and divvy it up according to the partnership agreement. That's a very good thing in our partnership system. What we're describing here is that some people have expertise, some people have capital. Those people come together. And they make some magic. They go out, they make some money, they make some capital gains, they make some assets. Think of it on a much smaller scale than what we're talking about here. What you're basically saying is that someone can't go to an expert chef with some money and say, look, I can't cook macaroni and cheese, but I know you're an expert chef. I've got some money. If I give you some money and you open up a restaurant and we make some money together, can we split the profits together? Are you going to really say that that's not a legitimate business arrangement anymore in the United States of America? That's exactly what we're talking about here, a partnership where some people have money and some people have skill.
But, you have skill. I have skill. My dentist has skills, but they don't get to pay taxes at the capital gains. I don't. You know, I pay on ordinary taxes.
Well, in this
taxes.
Restaurant that we're talking about, if they sold the restaurant, they do a really good job. They build it up. It's the hot new restaurant in town. They go and they sell it to somebody else. They'll have a capital gain on their hands.
I don't know. I hear what you're saying, but, you know, we get together, make a partnership. You put in $100 million. I put in nothing, but I'm savvy. Why shouldn't I get paid like a good attorney gets paid or a good accountant?
Because we're talking about a capital gain. We're
not
talking about
wage income. I'm not risking my own
capital.
I'm not risking.
It doesn't matter.
Well,
it's the partnership's gain.
Yeah, we're talking about
a partnership gain here.
That's
which is
the way the rules are
the
set
partners.
Up. We could change the rules. Victor Fleischer, what about it? This is where the magic is made, and it's only fair. It's the American way, and it makes sense to Ryan Ellis.
Yeah, a description of current law, which is what Ryan has tried to provide, is not an argument for the way that the rules should work. And clearly, the way that the rules should work is if you're an investment services partner, your services income should be taxed at ordinary rates. And I would add that, you know, what Mr. Ellis is calling magic, the magic that happens inside the partnership, it's not magic. And I think the caller from Milwaukee might have a different opinion of the social value of what the private equity fund managers are doing and whether they need this special tax break.
But surely, yes, there's been lots of companies that have been gutted and lots of problems with that. But over time, creative destruction is what capitalism's about, Victor, is it not? And isn't that what the magic is supposed to be here? Painful if you're on the losing end of it.
That's right. And it doesn't require a special tax subsidy. All I'm arguing for here is that whether you're in the private equity business or whether you're an attorney or whether you're a school teacher, that you pay tax on your labor income at ordinary rates in our progressive tax structure. That's the fundamental piece of our tax structure in the United States is that as you earn more money, you're supposed to pay tax at a higher rate on your labor income.
What about the macaroni restaurant analogy here? I know how to make great macaroni. You've got money. We open a restaurant. Shouldn't I get a cut? Is that what the private equity guys are entitled to, that kind of a metaphor for their work?
Well, that's obviously a different context, and I'm sure Mr. Ellis knows that the proposals to change the carried interest loophole would not apply to operating businesses. And really, what the macaroni partners are doing is more comparable to founder stock, to if you start a technology company and you take common stock in the company, we do treat that as an investment. None of the current proposals would change that treatment. None of the current proposals would change the true business partners. What we're talking about is limited to investment fund partners.
Fawn Johnson, does this have a chance of being knocked down in this next tiny handful of days in Washington? We've got a lot of voices talking about it, but of course it's easy to push it off into after 2016 or never land.
Well, and there is one very powerful opponent of getting rid of this particular provision in Congress, and that is Paul Ryan, who is the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And he has said over and over again that I don't think he is necessarily opposed on principle to changing that particular provision, but he wants it to be in the context of broader tax reform. He and many other Republicans and actually quite a few Democrats on the Hill are really trying to get to a place where you can rationalize the income tax brackets and also bring down the corporate tax rate, which is one of the highest in the world. But in order to be able to do that, you need to have some tricks that you can pull, and the carried interest is a perfect one to actually help offset some of the costs of it. And I think that's been the conversation. You hear that a lot, actually, in Congress from other Republicans who aren't involved in tax writing per se. They want, if you're going to do something individually, it really shouldn't mess up the scheme for doing something more comprehensive down the road. So I don't see anything like that happening, certainly not now, not this year. Next year, I could see it coming up in a conversation on broader tax reform, but it's a presidential year. So that means it'll slow down.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it.
That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about tax reform, a tax reform that President Obama and Donald Trump and apparently now Jeb Bush might all agree on, that is, getting rid of the carried interest provision, much used and beloved by private equity folks and more, that lets them earn a lot and be taxed at a capital gains rate, while others, maybe their secretaries, are paying more. And others who work hard for a living and make quite a lot will pay a lot more, maybe double what they pay on earned income. With Victor Fleischer of the University of San Diego, Fawn Johnson at Morning Consult, Ryan Ellis is with us from Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist Group in Washington. Lots of response online here. We've got a listener says, I can picture a scene right out of Blazing Saddles. Give me the carried interest loophole or the economy gets it. The private equity guy is threatening there. Kathy says, the fact we have any discussion about this is an indictment of the American political system. Obviously, it should be taxed as income. But here one of our listeners, Big Brother, says, don't assume that lowering tax rates reduces total tax collections. Lower rates change behavior. Don't assume they'll be bigger either. Yes, change the rates, you change behavior. Ryan, are you bulletproof on this? Do you think this is really in trouble, or is this a populist, that's the word of the season, talking point on the campaign trail?
We just frame the expectations here a little bit. The Joint Tax Committee, which is the official scorekeeper in Congress, says that if you were to do as being described here, which is to tax a capital gain, and that's what we're talking about, to tax a capital gain and pretend that it's ordinary income, that would raise $1.5 billion with a B per year, as Fawn's pointed out. Well, we all learn fractions in school. That's the numerator. What's the denominator there? The denominator is $3.5 trillion, which is what the federal government takes in tax revenue every year. This is not even a rounding error. It's not even an asterisk. This isn't going to result in some magic budget pay for. It's not even going to be a meaningful impact as a pay for in tax reform. This is a gimmick. This is something that people are doing because they want to stoke up fear and envy and resentment against people that make a lot of money somewhere else. And frankly, it's all part of a larger plan. It's been around for about 10 years now, on the part of Democrats to try to tax all capital gains as ordinary income. This is the first volley here. This is camel's nose under the tent.
Well, that's blowing the world up in a big – I don't know if we can make that case here today. People could do what they want to do. I mean, Republicans would like to get rid of an awful lot of taxes. But we've got such inequality. If it's so small, you know, the ratio of here, numerator, denominator is so off, then why not? We could use the money to do some good things. And surely, I mean, we're talking about guys who were making $467 million each in the hedge funds world last year at the top.
Tom, if I can make a point on revenue, this is Victor Fleischer.
Yes, please.
The Joint Committee estimate is almost surely low by an order of magnitude.
You're saying it's $180 billion over 10 years.
$180 billion over 10 years.
How can it be that different, your estimate, Victor?
And so I've got two columns in the New York Times that describe my methodology in more detail. But if you simply start counting from the biggest funds and work your way down, you pretty quickly get to figures that are much greater than the Joint Committee's estimate. I mean, one man, Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone, made $750 million in carried interest last year and would have paid over $200 million more in taxes. That already gets you to over 10% of the Joint Committee's estimate. It's just not plausible.
And Tom, I should just say, not only does that not square with the Joint Committee on Taxation's numbers on this, which are the official scorekeepers in Congress, Doug Holtz-Eakin, the former CBO director, did a rebuttal article to Victor's article earlier this summer and agreed with the Joint Tax Committee on this. So I really don't think those are reliable numbers.
Victor, give us a sense. We can all go and read it, but give us a sense of how you get an order of magnitude greater revenue than the Joint Tax Committee foresees.
Yeah, the critical move that the Joint Committee does, and obviously they did this in good faith, as their estimate of the behavioral response, the way that fund managers would respond, they use data from investment partnerships looking at how investors respond to changes in capital gains rates. And, Mr. Ellis is correct that, you know, if you change the capital gains rate, investors might respond by holding on to assets for a longer period of time. The problem is that the carried interest is not investment income, it's labor income. And it's not like people are going to stop becoming fund managers or that private equity fund managers are going to stop selling investments because there's a change in their personal tax rate. They're going to sell their investments when it makes sense to do so from a market perspective, and they're going to earn the income at that time. And so if they used a labor income estimate instead of an investment income estimate, their figures would have been in line with my estimates.
Well, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. What would happen is the pension funds, the charitable trusts, and everybody else that's actually the cash investors in these private equity funds, pension funds especially, are going to find themselves with less of a profit share than they did before, because these private equity managers, these guys are going to demand, instead of a 20% profit share, they're going to demand a 30 or a 35% profit share because they have a higher tax rate to pay. That's going to come out of the hides.
There's got to be a point at which that doesn't work. I mean, you can only hold somebody up for so much, right? I mean, Steve Schwarzman, okay, he make $500 million instead of $700 million.
It's not like the fund managers are only charging 20% out of the goodness of their hearts. That's the best number that they can get out of their investors.
I want to get Nick in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Nick, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. You always have such great shows and great topics and intelligent guests.
Thank you.
I live in an upper-middle-class neighborhood in Michigan. I earn about $300,000 a year. I live in a 2,500-square-foot house.
Okay. You're doing just fine, Nick. You're doing fine.
I agree. I'm doing great. When I was in economics class back in high school in the 70s, we were taught back then that on a sliding scale, you had capitalism at one end of the scale, you had communism at the opposite end of the scale, and in the middle you had socialism. And the United States, somewhere between capitalism and socialism, the USSR was somewhere between communism and socialism.
In other words, we had Social Security and, yeah, okay, yeah.
Neither country was ever on a pure capitalist or communist basis. Yeah. So I live in a 2,500-square-foot house. I could afford more, but I don't need to live in an estate, you know? Back in the Eisenhower administration, millionaires were taxed at 90%, weren't they? And up until the 1960s and I think the 70s.
But in the end, it's not about you or them. I mean, why should, Ryan Ellis says this works. Why change it?
Here's my point. Once you get to a certain level of income where you are a billionaire or somewhere close to it, you can afford to rig the system in your favor even more. And that takes all the equality out of everything in the United States and what we stand for, where everybody is supposed to have a chance to succeed.
Nick, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. We're going to be talking about Volkswagen in just a second here. Fawn, what do you think we're going to hear this week in Washington? Is there going to be more fireworks around this? Donald Trump's going to come out with his plan sooner. Does this all get sort of lapped over into the actual 2016 year, and we're going to be hearing about it in presidential debates?
I think we will be hearing about it in presidential debates for sure, because hedge fund guys is a great is a great term to use, particularly in polling. In Congress, where it's going to show up, it will be any efforts that they try to tweak the tax code. So right now there's a current both the Finance Committee in the Senate and the House Ways and Means Committee have bills going to extend a bunch of smaller tax provisions. So we'll see it there, but probably no other place.
Well, watch this space, at least rhetorically and maybe more. Billionaire Donald Trump says getting away with murder, and that's a phrase that sticks too. Fawn Johnson at Morning Consult, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Fawn, great to have you back with On Point.
Happy to be here.
Ryan Ellis at Americans for Tax Reform in Washington. Thank you for joining us, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
And Victor Fleischer, University of San Diego. Thanks so much for being there, Victor.
Thank you, sir.
In a moment, Volkswagen gets caught apparently cheating on EPA regulations on a massive scale. This is On Point. Volkswagen stock has nosedived since word broke that the company has allegedly been cheating for years on U.S. air pollution tests, emission testing, programming a massive evasion of emissions monitoring into their cars. To tell us about the story, Kevin Tynan joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. He is senior autos analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We're talking in ginormous here. This going on for years. Volkswagen, I'm reading, by one estimate, potentially facing an $18 billion fine. I don't know if you can even picture actually levying a fine of that scale. What is it alleged that they did?
So they created what's called a defeat device, and actually that $18 billion number is a little bit low because they can actually be fined for each defeat device as well as for violating the certificate of coverage of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
So,
what's a defeat device? What is that?
So basically what happens is they tamper with the software in the vehicle. So the vehicle actually knew when it was being tested, the conditions around testing the vehicle for emissions. So it would sort of run on its best behavior, its cleanest mode, recognizing when it was no longer on the dyno or in the lab, out on the road, it would operate at its normal capacity, which was much more pollutive than it would be during the test in the lab.
And we're talking like 40 times more pollutive, I'm reading, I think, here.
Yeah, that's correct. They said 10 to 40 times more pollutive on the road than it was in the lab.
I mean, just to look at this, this is not something that can happen by accident, a defeat device showing up in lots of automobiles.
Yeah, and that's a big deal in the sense that who knew what? When did they know it? I find it hard to believe that this would be something where it would be an engineer in a lab saying, we need to get these vehicles compliant. Let's go ahead and do this. You know, essentially what you're doing is you're doing the cost-benefit analysis of saying it's easier to just defeat this test than actually make the vehicles compliant in the first place. And I would imagine that's the kind of thing that might run pretty far up the management ladder. And to that end, I wouldn't be surprised to see this scandal end with some sort of board or management action.
We're talking about 482,000 Volkswagen diesel-powered cars, including those with the four-cylinder 2.0-liter turbo direct injection TDI, commonly in Passats and Jettas, Golf, the Beetle, and of course, Audi is the sister company there in the A3 compact model. Yeah, somebody had to like send this down, Jimmy the software, so that we pass. I mean, it just sounds like such an outrageous idea in the first place. The advantage was what? They could then put nice numbers up when they're selling the cars for environmentally conscious consumers to look at and say, oh, I want that.
Right, and what's really interesting too, Tommy, is that if you look at the amount of diesel vehicles sold in the U.S., it's about 1% of the total. Volkswagen, through, as you said, Volkswagen and Audi, and even there's one Porsche turbo model now, okay, not included in this, is about 60% of those diesel sales.
Wow, very dominant.
Yeah, very dominant. And most of the other automakers, and I'm sure you're familiar, have chosen other alternative drivetrain, fuel-efficient technologies, be it Toyota with the hybrids or something like the Chevrolet Volt will plug in hybrid electric or Tesla with the electric vehicles. So really the diesel segment, for what it's worth, was left to Volkswagen. All the other automakers went and pursued other technologies. So this was really Volkswagen's segment, and it seems like they screwed it up royally by by enabling the vehicles with these defeat devices. It seems like they shot themselves in their own feet in this case.
Not to mention a lot of consumers who bought these diesel vehicles thinking that they were doing something good for the environment. I have friends who have, I know they've taken satisfaction for years. I'm driving this low emission, car and I feel so good about it. Well, no.
And that was the marketing, right? The marketing was clean diesel, right?
Yeah.
I actually had a loaner vehicle from Audi not all that long ago in an A7 to test this clean diesel technology. And in giant vinyl letters down the side of this white car, it said clean diesel TDI. So it was the cornerstone of their marketing. It was how they were going to reach their 800,000 unit by 2018 in the U.S. sales goal. I mean, this was how they were going to do it. They carved out the diesel niche and they were going to own it, and they did. That's why this is so surprising of why you would go to these lengths.
What about really... that, Kevin? I mean, where does a company with this much potentially on the line get the nerve to do this? Did they think that the EPA was so foolish that it would never be noticed?
It's mind-boggling. It really is. And again, if this is going to be how you're going to position your vehicles, it's just mind-boggling that you would choose a technology that you knowingly have to cheat on to get the vehicles compliant. When it's such a small part of the market to begin with, you would think that, say, hey, let's partner with somebody that's already doing hybrid technology, gasoline hybrid, or electric vehicle technology, and go that way. That seems to be the future. So
maybe somebody up top had a bonus on the line if they could hit their sales goals. Well, seriously, I mean, I don't know. Why else would you do it? How was this discovered? You've got the International Council on Clean Transportation, nonprofit research outfit, and the West Virginia University researchers. Why were they even poking around here? Who suspected? How did it happen?
Right. Well, what happened was that the numbers in the lab just didn't jive with the numbers out on the road. And it really, I think it was an issue where we want to confirm these numbers. I don't think they were really looking for anything. And West Virginia got involved because they have the technology to test the vehicles that is portable. So like I said, the defeat device would let the vehicle be aware when it was in the lab being tested. West Virginia comes into this because they had the portable technology to test the vehicles. And then when those tests were being done, the numbers just didn't line up. And then it got deeper. They started an investigation. And once they pulled Volkswagen into it, eventually they admitted that they had equipped the vehicles with the defeat devices.
Just still mind-boggling to think that somewhere in a lab the order came down, make this software to lie. And now they're looking at, well, could be $18 billion in fines, could be more. Very tough for Volkswagen. Kevin Tynan, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Kevin Tynan with Bloomberg Intelligence, senior autos analyst there. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Be sure to find out tomorrow's topics and guests. You can go to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button, not dislike yet. Wait on it. Zuck is coming. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. It takes a lot of people to make this happen. Fatima Tanis, and David Tarantino help us out. Executive producer Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.